Rabbi said, we'll get started. Is that okay?
Wow, absolutely.
So I'll tell you where we're up to officially, but I do want to just retrace our steps a little bit and summarize. We're now on Daf Yud Ches on the Beis, and we're up to Tanur Rabbanan, which is about six lines up from the bottom, Tanur Rabbanan. But let me just recap what we did before. We had a statement of Rami Bar Chama to distinguish between two different claims of the Eidim. As far as being forced to sign the shtar, in other words, they were compelled to sign the shtar under duress. And Rami Bar Chama distinguished between two categories. One category is called anusim hayinu machmas mamon, and they were forced; they were pressured under a loss of money to sign the shtar, even though it's a fabrication. And the other is called anusim hayinu machmas nefashos, where their life was on the line, their lives were on the line. And according to Rami Bar Chama's statement, when the Mishnah establishes that they are believed to say anusim hayinu, that only applies if there's no self-incrimination. Because if they're incriminating themselves, that's a violation of the rule ein adam meisim atzmo rasha. Person's not believed to incriminate themselves. So if they made the statement anusim hayinu machmas nefashos, they're not incriminating themselves, because in fact the halacha requires them, in order to save their own lives, to sign this shtar, even though it's a falsification, because otherwise they'll be killed. If on the other hand they're saying anusim hayinu machmas mamon, then they're incriminating themselves, because there's no way that the Torah could allow you to violate this terrible Isur of Sheker and falsely sign a shtar for the sake of saving mamon. That's a no-go. And therefore, since they're incriminating themselves in a case of anusim hayinu machmas mamon, we don't believe them. That was the statement of Rami Bar Chama. The question is, are they ready, Dami Bais? The question is, on what part of the Mishnah is Rami Bar Chama's statement being made? Because there are two parts to the Mishnah. There's the Reisha and the Seifa. We're having a shiur here. Yeah, we don't usually knock on doors, but you could always come around this way without knocking on the door. Okay then?
Just want to check out who was here. I heard some noises.
You thought it was the boogeyman.
I thought it was a ghost, maybe. Are you a ghost?
I'm going to try to apply for the job. We'll see if they'll accept my resume. Okay. Now, what's the Reisha? What's the Seifa? The Reisha says that if there's no way of verifying the shtar, authenticating it, and establishing that there's no forgery, there's no way of doing that except through the testimony of these two Eidim, then they're believed. They're believed to invalidate the shtar based on the principle of hapesha asur, hapesha hitir. If in the Seifa, however, we already have evidence to establish the validity of the shtar, independent of these Eidim, we don't need the Eidim shtar to testify that this is their signatures. We have ksav yodim yotzei makom acher, we have another shtar in which they signed, and that shtar was already validated by Beis Din, and now we can compare the signatures. In those cases, the Eidim are not believed. And the reason for that is because of the principle of Kevan Shehigid, Shuvein Echozer Umad. So Rami Bar Chama's distinction, when he says they're believed because they said Anusim Ayinu Machmas Nefashos, and there's no self-incrimination because they were meant to sign the shtar to save their lives, but they're not believed to say anusim hayinu machmas mamon, on what part of the Mishnah were they making that statement? Initially, the Gemara thought that Rami Bar Chama's statement was going on the Seifa of the Mishnah. The Seifa says that they're not believed. Right? The Seifa says that since there's ksav yodim yotzim makam acher, therefore they're not believed. Says Rabbi Bar Chama, the reason they're not believed is because they said anusim hayinu machmas mamon. But if they would say anusim hayinu machmas nefashos, they would be believed. And Rava says that makes no sense, because since in the Sefer we have the principle of Kevan Yitzruv and Chozer Magid, so forget about the fact that there's no self-incrimination here, and they were perfectly in line with the halacha when they signed the shtar under the duress of Pikuach Nefesh. But nevertheless, we still can't believe them, because they are not believed to invalidate the shtar, since the shtar is valid on its own. Once the shtar is valid on its own, is Kevan Shehigin Shuvein Chozer Umag. Therefore, Rava corrects our mistake and says that Rabbi Bar Chama's qualification is going not on the Sefer, but rather it's going on the Reisha. The Reisha says that the Edim are believed because there's no independent evidence to establish the validity of the shtar, which gives the Edim a Pesh Asa Pesh Hitir. The Pesh Asa Pesh Hitir, says Rabbi Bar Chama, gives them a certain level of credibility of Nemanus, but not absolute Nemanus. It goes up until a certain point and it stops there. And what we have against the Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir is the halach of Ein Adam Mesim Atzma Rasha. So in other words, this deficiency, this negative dimension of Ein Adam Mesim Atzma Rasha, is going to hold back, put the stop on the Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. And therefore, Rabbi Bar Chama says that in the Reisha, even though they have a Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir, they're not believed to incriminate themselves by saying Anusim Ayinu Machmas Momon and invalidate the shtar, because we have a rule Ein Adam Mesim Atzmo Rosh. And that leads us to Tana Rabbana. That's where we want to start tonight. Tana Rabbana. The Braisa records a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And we're talking about a case of a shtar she'eno mekuyam, meaning the ratio, like the ratio in our Mishnah, and the Eidim testify about this shtar, that we signed the shtar, but the shtar is invalid for one of three reasons. Either because anusa bayinu, or ketanim bayinu, or psule eidim bayinu. So Rabbi Meir here in this braisa says, Ein ne'manim leposlo. The Eidim are not believed to invalidate the shtar. Rabbi Meir therefore seems to contravene the basic principle of HaPesha Asa or HaPesha Hita. That's a problem, because HaPesha Asa or HaPesha Hita is such a well-accepted principle that applies here, there, and elsewhere. That it's hard to believe that Rabbi Meir would reject the principle of HaPesha Asa Pesha Hita. So we'll give two classical cases of HaPesha Asa Pesha Hita that we've already discussed. Let's just review them. A woman comes here and she wants to get married. We have no reason to assume that she's married. Her chazaka is a cheskes pnuya. Now she says that I was married. That's called HaPesha Asa. And then she says, but I received a divorce. So imagine a case of a woman who comes in from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Have you ever been to Kalamazoo? I don't even know if the place exists, but let's assume it exists, but there's no Beis Din in Kalamazoo. So she says that in Kalamazoo she was married off by an Orthodox rabbi, and she received a get, ultimately, to divorce her from her husband in the Beis Din in Kalamazoo. Well, there ain't no Beis Din in Kalamazoo. So despite the Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir, she can't say something that's absolutely assumed to be false. Meaning if we have positive and powerful evidence to contradict what she's saying, then we're going to throw out Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. And that seems to be what Rabbi Meir is doing over here. He's saying, yeah, we do accept Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir as a general rule, but only if it has some logical credibility to it. If it contradicts the basic evidence and the assumption that we work with, then Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir has to be thrown overboard. So let's say, for example, a man comes to you and he says to you, you know what, this field belonged to your father, but I bought it from him. That's a classical Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. Well, if he says something that makes it absolutely ludicrous, ridiculous to believe that he actually bought this field, you know, he says the Beis Din in Kalamazoo oversaw the sale, whatever it might be, and there's no Beis Din in Kalamazoo, then Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir is not reliable. The Chachamim say in this brisa, Nemanim. The Edom are believed to say, Tanim Ayinu, Psui Edus Ayinu, Anusim Ayinu, because Peshasa Peshahitir. There's no way of being Makayim the Shtar independent of the Edom. And therefore, we rely on Peshasa. Bishlema says the Gemara, the Rabbanan, I understand the Rabbanan, Shita Kita Mayhu. Their claim and their logic is clear. HaPesha Pesasa Peshahitir. The whole possibility of being Mekayim Nishtar and validating it is based on their testimony that these are our signatures. So you can't just believe them to say, well, Ksav Yadenu who's there, and then stop, throw them out of the court, and don't allow them to finish what they're saying. If they were liars, and they wanted to invalidate the Shtar, they didn't have to do a thing. They could have stayed in their living room as couch potatoes. They didn't have to come to Beis Din at all. We have no way of verifying the Shtar. The Shtar, therefore, is invalid. The Lova says to the Malva, I never borrowed money from you. This is a forgery. We have no way of being Mekayim the Shtar. The Malva's out in the cold. He has no way of collecting his money. So why did the Edom come in? Elo what? The Edom are honest people. They want to tell you that in fact we did sign the Shtar. And we are coming to be Mekayim the Shtar. But the Shtar is possible for another reason. Either because of Ketanim Ayinu, Psui Edus Ayinu, or Anusim Ayinu. Say the Chachamim, in such a case, HaPesha Osu, HaPesha Yitna. What's your problem? Ella, the Rabbi Meir, my time, could it be the Rabbi Meir rejects the principle of HaPesha Osa HaPesha Hitir? That's a well-accepted fundamental principle. As we said before, a woman is believed to say, I was married, but I received my divorce. A man is willing to, is Neman, is believed to say that this field belonged to your father, but I bought it from him. Why would Rabbi Meir undermine the principle of HaPesha Osa HaPesha Hitir? And the answer is going to have to be that there's something against the Peshasa Peshitir. Otherwise, Rabbi is rejecting Peshasa Peshitir. The Gemara doesn't see that as a valid option. We must assume that Rabbi Meir, like the Chachamim, embraced and operates all over Shas with the principle of Peshasa Peshitir. It is so fundamental that no one could question its halachic tokef, its validity. But what happens if we have something to contradict the Peshasa Peshit? And that's what we're going to go through now, all three cases. Cases of Psuli Edus Hayinu, Ketanim Hayinu, Anusim Hayinu, and we're going to try to find out why Rabbi Meir believes that in each one of these three cases, it's like the Edom are saying, you know, there's a Beis Din in Kalamazoo. They're saying something that's ludicrous that we cannot accept. Number one. Bishleim, I can understand Rabbi Meir, Psule Edus Hayinu. Imagine if the Edom testified that we signed the Shtar, but we were brothers-in-law. We were married to two sisters. And that makes us into Psulim, that's called Krovim. Rabbi Meir can't accept that. No credibility to the Edom. Why? What contradicts the Edom? Malva Gufe Meikara Medik Daik Umichtam. Now let's clarify. Who writes the Shtar? Or to be more precise, who commissions the writing of the Shtar? It's the Lova. That's called Das HaMeschayev. The Lova stands to lose. He's got to commission the signing of the Shtar. But who's going to get the Shtar after the Shtar is created? The Shtar is going to be given from the hands of the Lova to the hands of the Malva, because the Malva is not willing to give $1 million loan without some sort of document that gives him the security and guarantees that he'll be able to prove and collect his loan. Now the Malva is gonna have to do his, I call it due diligence, because he's putting a lot of money on the line here. He's offering a very handsome sum of money, let's call it $1 million, I'm just giving an example, of a loan, and everything depends on that shtar. If that shtar is not valid, if a Beis Din will throw that shtar out, he is now losing $1 million. He has no recourse to claim that $1 million. Everything depends upon the shtar. So what's the Malva going to do? Is he going to allow two brothers-in-law to sign the shtar? Loco moco? Is he crazy? It's like when I'm a Sadek Kedushin, so I say to the two Edim under the chuppah, are you related? And I ask them, and I'm choker, v'dorish them. Same thing with the signing of the ksuba. I don't want any relative signing the ksuba. In the case of the malva, he's got to do his due diligence. Otherwise, he's a total imbecile. How can you take a shtar without knowing for sure that these edim are not psulim, but rather ksherim? So Rabbi Meir says there's just such a strong evidence that weighs in to the fact that these edim are not psulim, that we can't even believe them when they say the psulim, despite the fact that they have a peshas and peshit. In other words, Rabbi Meir puts on the scale, on one side of the scale he's got peshas and peshit there, on the other side of the scale he says, chazaka she'ena malva chosev edim elim kek sherim, hey, right? And therefore, since there's a Vedic dayak on the part of the Malva, that overwhelms, overcomes, or trumps, I guess you could say, the validity of Peshas and Peshit.
There's an opinion that disagrees with Rav Meir.
And that's the Chacham.
Right. The Chacham would say, even though that's so far-fetched, we're still
going believing the aid.
Right, is that...
I suspect are in one of two things. Either the Chachamim say, you know what, maybe right. Somehow they slip by,
right.
And unbeknown to the Malva, these Edim were psulim. I'll give you an example. You see, I told you that the Edim are married to two sisters. Let's give another example. One of the Edim is a Masachik Bekubia. Now, it's quite possible that he conceals that identity. Most of the time, a Masachi Bekuvia is pretty well known in town. But imagine the case of a large metropolis, or the case of a Masachi Bekuvia who's thinking about doing tshuva, so he took a week's break or so, and then they checked him out. What we find is in all these birurim, like in Shaduchim, they always tell you, they sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, if you know that phrase. They'll tell you everything is hunky-dory and everything's well. Maybe they squeezed by. That's one way of interpreting the Chacham. I'm more inclined to a different interpretation of the Chacham. And the machlokas here between Chacham and Rav Meir is very fundamental. They're arguing about the nature of Pesha Asa Pesha Hite. Rabbi Meir understands that Pesha Asa Pesha Hite, like Migu, is a kind of an evidence that tips in favor of supporting their credibility. If they were liars, why would they bother with this? That belongs to what I call Hilchas Raya's. And therefore, Rav Meir says, if that Raya is vulnerable, is exposed to another Raya, if I care, to the opposite conclusion, then throw it out. I think the Chachamim are penetrating to a much more profound yisod, a much more deeper fundamental premise about how Peshasa Peshaiter works. Do you remember we discussed something called the status quo? The question is, if the status quo is going to change, what statement, what declaration, what testimony is going to have the power to change the status quo? The Chachamim understand that Peshas or Peshahitir prevents a change of the status quo. The status quo of the shtar is that the shtar is invalid. The only way you could validate the shtar is through the declaration of these edim. What our Peshas or Peshahitir says is take that declaration as an entity, as a whole. You may believe it, you may not believe it, but whatever it is, that's inseparable, indivisible. You cannot split it down the middle. You can't stop a person in the middle of his statement. If he says HaPesha Asa, and without taking even a breath of a pause, he says HaPesha Yitir, you have one of two choices. Either believe him, or throw the whole thing out of court. There's no middle of the ground. You have no right to split him in the middle. Rabbi Meir is splitting him in the middle. Rabbi Meir is saying, we'll believe you to validate the shtar, and establish Ksav Yadenu who said that these signatures are authentic. But we're not going to believe you to say Psuli Eidu Sayyid. Chachamim say the following. Maybe you're right that we shouldn't believe them to say Psuli Eidu. After all, the Malva would never have let that go through, made it dying. But you know what? You don't want to believe them? Just don't believe them on anything. Don't split them in half. There's no palgina dibur allowed here. You can't say we'll believe them on the resha and not on the sefer. When they say ksav yadenu zeh, that's valid. And now the shtar is mukuya. But when they continue and they tell us a story about psuli edus, you know, we didn't hear that. We're deaf. You know, we ignore that totally.
Why can't we take that approach?
So the chachamim hold that hapeshas hapeshit means the indivisibility of a person's declaration. You can't tell me, well, I believe him for this, but I don't believe him for that. I'm going to rely on him for this statement and not for that statement. For example, if I'm living on karka for the last 50 years, and you are and have no clue in a million, there's no reason it would dawn on you that this karka might belong to you, and you inherited it from your ancestors. That chazaka is the status quo. I'm assumed to be the legitimate owner of that field, of that piece of real estate. Now I come to Best, and I say, you know what? This karka once belonged to your father, to your grandfather, to your great-grandfather. But I bought it. So the Chachamim say there are one or two choices here. Either you don't believe the guy and throw the whole thing out of court, go back to the status quo, and he's muksa, or you believe him on the entire totality of what he said. But to believe him halfway, that this karka belonged to your father, but not to believe that he bought it from your father, that you can't do. That's why Rabbosai Pesha Asa Pesha Hita is only Tolkidei Dibur. In other words, he can't take a pause. If she comes into Bez and she says, Eishas Isha Isi, and then she comes back 5 minutes later and she says, well, I have news for you, I received a get, she's not believed. Why? Because the whole force or power of Pesha Asa Pesha Hita is the indivisibility of the statement. You can't split the Pesha Hasar from the Pesha Hitir, or I should say the other way around. You can't take the Pesha Hitir and not the Pesha Hasar. You can't take one half of the other.
And you can't accept both halves and then question it?
Well, again, if you're accepting both halves and then you're questioning, you got to question both halves. If you're questioning both halves, then the Shtar is not a Shtar Makud. Rabbi Meir is willing to pick and choose. You know what? When you tell us Ksav Yadenu Zeh, that's fine. We trust you. Let's be Makai Mishtar. But then you add Psuli Eidus Hayinu, we don't trust you. The Malva would never have signed you up on the Shtar. Can't be. So we're not going to believe you on that. Say the Chachamim, at the end of the day, you know what you're doing, Rabbi Meir? You are splitting the statement into two parts. You're accepting the first part. You're being Makai Mishtar. You're changing the Cheskas Hashtar. But you're not believing him to say Psuli Eidus Hayinu. I'm not going to fight with you, say the Chacham to a mayor, that maybe we shouldn't really trust him on Psuli Eidus Hayinu. It's a very flimsy, iffy kind of claim. What do you mean Psuli Eidus Hayinu? Had the Malva let you get away with that? He did his due diligence. But even if I trust you, and I agree with you, that there's something iffy about the statement of Psuli Eidus Hayinu, you still can't validate the Shtar. What you could do is go back to square one, and that is a shtar she'ena makuyu. And if the loaf is saying I never borrowed the money, then the malf is out in the cold because he doesn't have ample proof to establish that the loaf borrowed money from him. So if you follow what I'm suggesting, the machlokas shin Rav Meir Chacham doesn't revolve around, well, did the Malva do his due diligence? Maybe it squeezed by. He didn't realize that this guy was once, you know, had a criminal record. He was a Masachi Makuvia. He was related to this guy because he married his wife's sister. No, forget about that. They're not arguing about the percentage points of evidence that weigh in favor of the fact that the Malva is Medik Daik. No, that's not the machlokas. The machlokas is about the nature of Pesha Asa Pesha Hiti. But Meir sees Pesha Asa Pesha Hiti as a push towards credibility. It's like a migu. And the Chacham say no. Pesha Asa Pesha Hiti is a separate halacha. And it's fascinating. The Gemara is going to establish later on in Masechet Ksuvos that Pesha Asa Pesha Hiti is derived from a pasuk. Es biti nasati le'ish hazeh. A father could testify that he married off his daughter. She's a ketana. But once, and at that point, she becomes an eshesish. No one's allowed to marry her. But then he adds le'ish hazeh. And the Gemara says he's believed to say le'ish hazeh that she's married off to this guy
because of apesha also apesha hitir. Now, if she wants to marry someone, all she needs is a get from this guy, because the father is believed to identify who the Makadish is. That's called pesha also apesha hitir. Why does the Gemara need a pasuk for that? Why not just use a regular umdana, a regular psychological proof that the guy's not a liar? If he was a liar, he didn't have to say as biti nasati. I would have derived this conclusion of a peshas a peshita from human logic. The answer is no. Peshas a peshita is derived from a pasuk, and it generates a halacha. We call it, Daniel, know what I'm referring to, a chal shem, right? It's a chal shem. Peshas a peshita means you got a certain chazaka, there's a status quo, you cannot change the status quo by splitting a person's testimony, accepting the resha and rejecting the sif. That's the chachomim shita. Good? Now we go on to the second case. Ketanim hayu. Now the Edom are saying, yes, we signed the shtar, but we were minors at the time. I don't mean minors in the sense of looking for coal. Minors in the sense that we were less than bar mitzvah. And if he's less than bar mitzvah, then the shtar is possible. The Edom is possible. We can't believe a katan. So the Gemara says, even that I can understand, Rabbi Meir. Ketanim nami, that's a very weak argument to say that you signed a shtar when you were a katan. Kid Rav Shim ben Lakish, the Omer Rav Shim ben Lakish, and here we move on to Daf Yutesam and Aleph. Chazaka, ein ha'edim chosmim al ashtar elim kem nasa begodol. Any sale, any transaction that has a shtar to it, and the edim are signed on the shtar, the Balei Dvarim, the Mocher and the Lokeach, would absolutely guarantee that these two signatures on the Shtar were signed by Gdolim and not by Ketanim. Because otherwise, the entire transaction is going to go down the tubes. We need Edim Ksherim who are Gdolim and not Ketanim.
Why do you need a new reason? Why not just use the same reason as before?
It is the same reason as before. Let me explain. The literal statement of Reish Lakish is not really relevant to us, so to speak. It's only relevant to us because the Gemara is going to make an analogy and jump from X to Y. The statement of Reish Lakish in its original pure form has nothing to do with our discussion whether the Edom should be believed that they signed when they were Ketanim. Mm-hmm. Really, the statement of Reish Lakish is relevant in its context to the fact that when two people enter into a transaction and they write a shtar to testify to that transaction, they make sure that the mocher, knows the lokech, makes sure that the mocher was a gadol, the mocher makes sure that the lokech is a gadol. Do you follow my point? Yeah. I'm not going to give you $1 million and then find out tomorrow that you're a katan. Let's say he's in that gray area, we don't know if he's 13 in a day, and so forth and so on. So I'm going to have to check that out before I either sell or buy something from him. That's Reish Lakish. And that's what Reish Lakish says, that the Edom themselves, when they sign on a shtar, what they know is that the mocher is a gadol and the lokech is a gadol. Because to the same extent that the mocher and the lokech will check each other out reciprocally to make sure that this sale is valid, so too the Edom have to know before they sign the shtar that there's a transaction that's valid. Now the Gemara is going another step further. Well, just like the Edom will not sign the shtar unless they are convinced that the Mocher and Lokech are both Gedolim, the Mocher and Lokech are not going to allow this transaction to go by with the shtar unless they know that the Edom are Gedolim and not Ketanim. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly the same as what we said back on Daf Yud Ches Amid Beis when we established that Malveh Gufeh Meikara Medik Dayik, he's going to be Medayik to make sure that what? That the Edom are Ksherim and Apsulim. And now we're saying that he's going to make sure, this Mr. Malva, that the Edom that are signed are Gedolim and Ketanim. Because again, the Malva is investing a lot of money. Everything depends upon the Shtar. It's got to be valid. The Malva is going to do his due diligence to make sure that the Edom are Ksherim and Ketanim. The Gemara just uses or borrows Reish Lakish's statement in a different context. If there's any issue about whether the Mocher or the Lokeach were Ketanim, then we're going to assume they were both Gedolim. And at the same token, the Mocher and Lokech are going to guarantee that the Edom that are signed on the Shtar are gedola. That's not exactly what Reish Lakish said. Reish Lakish said that the Eidim have to check out the Mocher and the Lokeach. We're going a step further by analogy and saying that the Mocher and the Lokeach, or the Malv and the Lov, have to check out the Eidim, make sure the Eidim are gedola. Hello, but here's where we get stuck. Anusim my time. Why is it that Rabbi Meir argues against the Chachamim when the Eidim come in and they say Anusim Ayinu? Is there some Chazaka that can tell you that they weren't Anusim? Well, you're going to tell me the Malva wouldn't have signed them. What are you talking about? The Malva is the mafioso who's forcing, who's compelling the Eidim to sign the Shtar. So from the perspective of the claim of the Eidim that we were compelled under duress to sign the Shtar, you have no proof against that. Now it's true that in most cases when Eidim sign on a Shtar, they do it out of their own free will. But there's no chazaka that tells you that there's no hanky-panky going here over here, on here. Now again, we're talking about a case of Anusim Ayinu Machmas. No, again, if it's Machmas Moment, even the Chachom would agree that the Eidim aren't believed, because that comes under the principle of what? Ein Adam Mesim Atzmo Rosha. Correct? Because you're not allowed to sign a shtar falsely because they're threatening to blow up your, you know, to kill your cows or something, poison your cows. So if the Chachomim are saying that we validate the claim of the Eidim, that they were Anusim when they signed the shtar, it must be that they were claiming Anusim Ayinu Machmas Nefashos, and therefore there's no problem of Eino the Mesim Atzmo Rosha. There's no self-incrimination, because what does the halacha say to a person whose life is being threatened, and the only way he can save himself from this threat is by signing a shtar and plagiarizing himself? Should he sign the shtar, or should he let his you know, let himself be killed? What would you say?
Plagiarize.
Why?
It's not one of the three.
Excellent. It's not one of the three. And if it's not one of the three, what principle applies? I'll give you a hint. It starts with V'chai. V'chai mem v'lo she yomus mem. And that's called Pikuach Nefesh. So Pikuach Nefesh is docha all Yisurim in the Torah, including falsifying a shtar, which is mitvar sheker tirchak, might come under some other law, like gram nezikin and v'haf l'recha kamocha, and he can really hit him with a whole list, but it doesn't come under gili arai shvichas dom and avodah zarah. So why would Rav Meir reject the testimony of the Eidim that achen, indeed we signed the shtar, but we were compelled under duress, under threat of life, and that's why we signed the shtar? The shtar is invalid because this was not Eidus MS, this was Eidus Sheker, which we agreed to sign because we had no choice in the matter. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Does that mean anything to you? No. Okay. It's an old movie, so... Now, Rabosai, the next line in the Gemara is, by my admission at least, the most difficult line I've ever seen in Shas. And sometimes I lose sleepless nights. I can't figure out how the Gemara says what it's about to say. Omar Rav Chisda, Kasava Rabbi Meir, Eidim Sha'amru Lehem Chismu Sheker, V'Alte Hargu, the Eidim at the threat of death could only save themselves if they sign this shtar and plagiarize themselves. Yehargu v'al yachtemu shek. They should sign the shtar. Excuse me. They should be killed rather than sign the shtar. Now the Gemara is about to reject it, but you know, I come from a school where they train me to believe that a statement is a statement. It could be rejected, but it's a statement. Rav Chisda made this statement. And he's, pardon the expression, accusing Rav Meir of holding that Yehareg Valyavar applies in the case of Chasimas Shtar Bishek. Now, in the footnote here in Masifta, he offers two interpretations. None of them, honestly, make me a happy camper. One, he says that the law of Yehareg Valyavar, according to Rav Chisda, applies to every single mitzvah in the Torah. There was never a big three, as we call it. The cardinal three averes. For any mitzvah of the law is you have to give up your life. Now, let me say something in defense of that approach, and then I'll tell you why I can't accept it. In defense of that approach, and he doesn't quote this, it is a sugya in Sanhedrin about Ben Noach. And the Gemara vacillates back and forth as to whether Ben Noach should give up his life for one of the seven mitzvahs. In other words, he's being compelled to violate one of the seven mitzvahs Ben Noach at the pain of death. Does he have to die? Or does he violate? Ultimately, the Gemara comes to the conclusion that he should violate any of the seven laws rather than be killed. Why? Because there's no mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem by a Ben Noach. But Tosis over there in Sanhedrin, I believe it's Samaches, Tosis explains the Havamin. Why did the Gemara think that a Ben Noach would have to give up his life for any of the seven? And Tosis says, because the Torah says V'chai Bohem, addressing the Jews, and not the non-Jews. And therefore, if there's no V'chai Bohem, and this overriding principle called Pikuach Nefesh was said for Jews but not for non-Jews, then as far as non-Jews are concerned, we go back to our original premise, which was our logical premise before V'chai Bohem. What was the Hava Mina before V'chai Bohem? That's right. Where do you have a head to violate the mitzvah? Yeah, as great as life is, you know, but so what? The Torah says don't violate. If the Torah says don't violate, where's your exception to the rule? Ella, what? Your exception to the rule is V'chai Bohem. That doesn't apply to a Ben Noach. And the maskana of the sugya is, according to Tosis, that the entire reason why you give up your life is not because of the premise that you have to give up your life, but because of the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. And that mitzvah was never given to a Ben Noach. But I can defend this approach of the Shita Mekubetzes here by saying that for any mitzvah in the Torah, you don't have to give up your life. And that's indeed at least a havamina in the sugya of Ben Noach.
That you do.
The only problem is state in pasuk v'chai bohem. Did Rav Meir not know this pasuk? Did Rav Meir not know that the whole shas, where you can't give me a masecht in shas that doesn't say pikuach nefesh is docha kol haTorah kulah? It's all over the place. It's plastered on every daf of a shas bav.
No, but here this is gilui. This here this could be gilui ra'as. Because if they're
Kiliya, right?
No,
whoa.
Why? Because okay, yeah. because if the document
this is a noob shot that I didn't find. Yeah, go ahead.
If the document in question is a get,
no. We're talking about a shtar mamon.
Okay,
right. We're not talking about a get. Okay. Then he has a second approach. What's his second approach? He says that even though there's no chiyuv to be moser nefesh for shtar mitzvus haTorah, nevertheless, it's a midas chasidus. It's going beyond the letter of the law to give up your life rather than violate any of these surim of the Torah. Now, I'll come back to my point in a minute, but in brackets, that's a gigantic machlokas between the Rambam and Rav Moshe Kohen. Okay, we'll get back to that in a second. But even if I grant his premise is correct, that it's a midas chasidus for one to give up his life for any avera in the Torah, that doesn't get us all, you know, all, safely all around the bases to our goal line, because so what? Why? Rameir is saying, ain't other mesa matzma rosha, you had no right to sign the shtar. He was allowed within the parameters of the law to sign the shtar and fabricate the whole truth, but it wasn't midas chasidus. So now he's telling me the following. Minhag ha'olam kachu. Wow, that's a heavy statement. The minhag of the olam is that I'd rather give up my life than sign sheker. Why? Because that's midas chasidus. And therefore the aid would never, you know, cast an aspersion, a doubt on his midas chasidus, since this minhag chasidus was the widely accepted minhag. Meaning, he himself here in this Shita Mekubetzes is very sensitive to the following argument, namely, okay, so I didn't live up to Midas Chasidus. I didn't live up to that super duper standard. So what, if I made myself into a Rasha? Nor of us, you have to add another principle here, another assumption, that it was the Midas Mekubal that we accept the Midas Chasidus. Now, I don't know if a Minog has the power to convert a Midas Chasidus into Ikar Adin. Let's assume that every single Jew on the face of the earth would accept upon themselves to commit themselves to a Midas Chasidus. It doesn't mean that someone who's not on that level is a Rasha. And therefore I want to activate the principle of Eino Demesim Atzma Rasha, as Rebbe Meir does over here. But beyond that, these two assumptions here, number one, that it's a Midas Chasidus to give up your life for any mitzvah, that's highly questionable. The Rambam is totally opposed to that. The Rambam says that when the halacha is v'chai b'hem on any mitzvah other than the big three, if he dies, he's a ma'abed atzmo l'das. He's a suicide case. The Rambam has no toleration for any sort of Midas Chasidus. Rabbeinu Moshe HaKohen, quoted by the Kesef Mishnah in Perkei Milchus Yisod Torah, says no. All through Jewish history, the Jews were willing to give up their lives, you know, Al-Kiddush Hashem, even for something less than the big three, and you can't tell me they're all suicide cases. Fine. So that's a gigantic plugta. And he's assuming Midas Chasidus against the Rambam.
As another explanation, that you give up your life for something bifarhesia, in other words, not to be an avera bifarhesia. So writing...
Well, no, avera bifarhesia, if I'm not mistaken, Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong, is
right.
Only... No, bifarhesia only applies...
Only in a, where the government is...
Only in a case of what's called lavuri al das, meaning, the Gemara says, for example, Esther was bifarhesia.
Right,
the Gemara is assuming that she was married to Mordechai.
Right.
And the Gemara says, no, he was like, no, it's atzmo shiny. You know, see, Achashverosh was not...
But how does the bifarhesia work? Only if it's...
No, bifarhesia means that they...
Or,
no, not necessarily the government.
They specifically want you.
They want you, right. They want you to show that,
right,
that you're, in your mind, in your judgment... Life is worth more than the Torah itself.
In this case, where it's a shtar, in other words, something that's going to that's public.
Okay,
that's
so
that's going to have a kol. That's going to be what?
Right. So,
that's, in other words, you're not just doing in front of two people. The shtar has this power of.
So I wanted to say something similar to you. Maybe yours is better than mine. Let me just throw out my idea, and we'll compare notes. I wanted to suggest that this is not a normal halacha of Yehorik Valiyav. Let me ask you the following question. Supposing Reuven puts a gun to Shimon's head and he says, I want you to change one letter in the Torah. And let's say that Sefer Torah will be used, let's say at a certain juncture in Jewish history, that Sefer Torah will be used for the transmission of Torah for generations to come. If you refuse to falsify one letter in the Torah, I'm just being dramatic about it, I'm going to knock your block off. What would you say about such a thing? It's not one of the big three. It's not Gilui Arayos. It's not Shvichas Damim. It's not Avodah Zarah.
Sounds like
then b'chai b'hem, pikuach nefesh is docha kol haTorah kula. So I say the following: pikuach nefesh is docha kol haTorah kula. Once you have the Torah, but if you don't have the Torah, then for sure you can't save your life. Do you follow what I'm saying? Within the Torah itself, when it comes to a specific ma'isa avera, then I apply the principle of b'chai b'hem. But to falsify the Torah itself, that's surely a Harik Val Yavra. That's a Harik Val Yavra that comes above everything. Because you're changing the Torah itself.
How is
you hear what I'm saying? Now, again, I didn't get to Shtar yet, but I'm just saying.
What's the example of that? I mean,
before we get to our Sugi of Shtar,
right.
I'm saying, here's my case.
So I understand
you remember that Chazal tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu had to write a Sefer Torah. That Sefer Torah was duplicated 12 times, one for each Shevet. And one extra Sefer Torah that was hidden in the Arish. Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah was not touched. No one could touch it because that would ultimately be the Sefer Torah from which we would compare any other Sefer Torah. Because again, there are so many letters in the Torah. Not 600,000, which it says there are, but anyway, I've got half that amount. But there's a whole lumpus on that too. But there's a lot of letters in the Sefer Torah. And what's going to happen over the course of time? Now, I don't know how many versions there are of Shakespeare's, you know, King Lear. I don't know. But I can guess that at least before the printing press, maybe after the printing press things changed, there were probably many, many different issues about, you know, letters here and letters there, right? At any book. But the Torah wanted to go out of its way to establish one final, you know, authoritative source for the Torah itself. And that was Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah. So somebody comes to Moshe Rabbeinu with a gun and says, just make one little change, one letter in the Torah, or I'll knock your block off. So Berzon says, and nobody here is committed to accepting, that Moshe Rabbeinu would have had to give up his life for such a thing. In other words, once the Torah is given, within the Torah, we can talk about weighing human life against violation of a specific Torah law, an avera mesuyemes. But if you're falsifying the Torah itself, that is for sure not allowed under any situation. The pikuach nefesh kicks in once you have the Torah. But if you're going to undermine the Torah itself, that's a problem.
Rabbi, didn't
that now, what does that have to do with Shtar?
No,
yeah. What does that have to do with Shtar? You know, even if what I said is true, what is that? How does that help me with Rabbi Meir?
Yeah. Didn't that exact case happen in Sefer Daniel? Weren't they asked?
I don't know. Please tell me. I'm not a Bucky in Sefer Daniel. It's too the Ivra there is too hard for me.
Weren't they asked?
Too much Aramaic for me.
Weren't they asked to independently do something? And
you're not talking about Talmai Amelech with the Septuagint. That's not what you're talking
about. You're talking about the
Septuagint. I forgot. Now I've confused myself. But I remember there being a case.
So there may be something in Sefer Daniel, but the Gemara tells the Masechta Megillah that Talmai, who was, I think, the Melech of Mitzrayim, he took 70 scholars and put them into different rooms, asked them all to change.
In the translation, they made changes.
Right, and then there was a great miracle, and Hashem put, even though they couldn't see each other or hear each other, he put into their minds translations.
Translation also made changes.
So isn't that the same case that you're talking about?
No, so again, I would say the following, that if let's say somebody would put a gun to the head of one of these Zakenim and say, falsify the Torah or I'll knock your block off, Ken Zayin, again, I don't know if this svara is they may kill me for this, pardon the pun, but it could be has to be killed for that rather than violate the
Torah.
So maybe, I'm just thinking out loud, that Rabbi Meir understood that Eidus in general, and maybe Kolshken in the case of a shtar, becomes part of the Mesoras HaTorah. What do I mean? You can ask the following question. Let's say questions will come up about a case that's actual now, and Bezdin has to issue a horah. They will, I'm suggesting, again, everything I say is, you know, with limited liability. We have to create a company for this, right? I'm suggesting that Beis Din will determine that halacha based on Hilchos Shtaros, on precedent. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that if you falsify a shtar, you're really falsifying the Torah itself. Why? Because the Mesoras of Horah will reflect a shtar that was written even 1,000 years ago. I'll give you an example. You know that when a woman gets divorced, she doesn't hold on to the get for more than a split second. Beis Din chaps the get from her hands. Why? Because they don't want the get to be out there in public and people will derive conclusions about the get, right? So, for example, I once witnessed the get for a Gioris, her name was Genevieve. And there was a whole machlokus amongst the Dayanim how to write the name Genevieve in Hebrew letters. You know, and they asked her to repeat it about 12 times, if not twice that amount. It was Genevieve, Genevieve. What?
Rue from LA put out a whole book of Seamus.
Oh, I could fill up this whole room with books on Seamus. Rav Henkin was the last word on Seamus. How do you write Jack, you know?
Your own name's like Jose.
Jose, I mean, I myself have a book that was authored by Rav Yosef Cohen. I heard shiurim from him. His son is Rav David Cohen, the Rashiv of Chevron Yeshiva. And Rav Yosef Cohen, who was the head of Machon Ari Fishel, himself wrote books on Seamus. Seamus, anyone who studies Gittin will spend most of his time on Seamus. That's what you have to know in order to be a Masader Get. And recently, I was asked to stand in front of the Beis Din and pronounce the name Joel. You know, the Dayanim have to hear the way I pronounce it in order to determine how to write the J. There's no J sound in Hebrew. It's mind boggling because the Iraqi Jews have a Th, and there's no Th in Hebrew. So in a Sephardic get, they'll actually write a Tough with a nekuda on top of it, but the Ashkenazic tradition doesn't allow that. The problem is that Ashkenazic Gittin don't allow such a thing. There are no nekudas in an Ashkenazic get. So a whole tradition was created in which. Now the biggest Masada get in Mid America was a man by the name of Greenwald. He authored a very famous work called the Kolbo on Avelus. It was like in its time, it was the last word on Avelus. But he was the Masader Gittin for the entire Mid-America. Anywhere, you know, let's say, west of Cleveland, all the way to Los Angeles, you know, always went through his bezdin. He was in a city called Columbus, Ohio. And there was a Gansa Plukta about how to write Columbus, Ohio in a get. Because, believe it or not, in a get, you have to mention the riverbank of the city. And the question is, how do you write Columbus? I forgot the name of the river that Columbus is on. You look it up in Google, and you'll figure it out. So after he died, the Masadre Gittin, who took over for him in that area, they wanted to see his Gittin in order to determine exactly what the tradition had to spell Columbus and how to write on the name of the river and all this stuff. So there's a whole story I don't want to go into because it'll be a little bit Lashon Hara, but somebody or other would not let them have access to the Gittin. I don't want to go into detail about that. And that created a tremendous hullabaloo because you can't create a new tradition about how to spell something in a get, you know. But in any event, what I'm just trying to point out is, in the case of Gittin, it's very difficult to say that the get is part of the Masoras HaTorah because the get is taken away. But in theory, if the get wasn't taken away, I'm just using that as an illustration, the exact dinim that applied to writing a get would be determined by the original gittin. So let's say we had a question about how to write this shtar, and this shtar was signed by two edim. We have every reason to believe that they're two honorable, respectable edim. And little did we know that these edim were forced at gunpoint to sign this shtar. We're going to derive halachas and conclusions from the shtar, equate our situation today and all the spakers to the situation of this shtar. Today, for example, you can go to the Hebrew Museum over here on Givat Ram, and they'll show you ksubis. It's very fascinating. If you know the laws of ksubis, you can really learn halachas, because they display ksubis from Tunisia and from this country and that country from hundreds of years ago. You know, those who collect Judaica, they love these kind of things. You know, a ksuba from 400 years ago, it's worth a whole tarfot. But you can really derive halachas from a shtar. So what I'm suggesting is that perhaps Rabbi Meir is not saying a halachin kol haTorah kula for any mitzvah. He puts a gun to my head and he says, take off your tzitzis or I'll kill you. So I have to allow myself to be killed. No. That's not what Rabbi Meir is saying. He's not saying that it's a midas chassidus to give up your life when you don't have to give up your life. No. I don't buy into that. What I'm suggesting is perhaps Rabbi Meir holds that you have to give up your life rather than sign a shtar. Because a shtar is a Heftzah Shel Torah. Why is a shtar a Heftzah Shel Torah? Because that shtar itself is going to be used as a Keresh Kvitzah, you know, to derive halachas by analogy. Then we have Rabbi Aaron's understanding that maybe since a shtar is public in nature, maybe it's an Aveir B'Farhesya. I counter argue that the halacha Farhesya only applies if it's Lavuri Al Das, meaning if they specifically, publicly want you to violate your Torah simply for the sake of violating your Torah, so we can prove that a Jew is willing to violate the Torah. That's where Farhesya kicks in. That's called Chilul Hashem. when a Jew makes a statement, my life is worth more than the violation of the Torah. But if it's lehanos atzmo komachafen, you know, the mouth that wants to collect a false claim, excuse me, $1 million for the lover, I don't know if our hesi would therefore generate. In any event, this Havamina of the Gemara is wild, mamish wild. The Gemara immediately rejects it. Ole Rava, Hashta, come on, give me a break, he says. Ilu asu lekamon lim luche. Imagine if these Edim could somehow pick up a secret phone while they're being compelled at gunpoint to the Bezdin and ask Bezdin, what should I do in this case? Let's say they knew beforehand that if they walk into this room, that's it. That, you know, they're going to get a, what we call an offer they can't refuse. What would we say to them? Amrinale zilu chasumu. Go sign the shtar. Volotis kaltu, tis katlun. Don't give yourselves up to die. Diomar mar aim. Now they did exactly what we would have advocated them doing. Why did you falsify and plagiarize yourself and sign the shtar? You're a Russia? And we can't even trust you when you say that you incriminate yourself? Ella. And now this Ella, Rabosai, starts a whole new sugya, almost, I would say. Well, it's not a new sugya, but it's a radical, shall I say, departure from everything that we've done until now. We've been assuming until this point that the whole sugya of Chachamim and Reb Meir revolves around Pesha Asa Pesha Hiti. No. That's not the name of the sugya. That's not what we're talking about. So let me give a short introduction. The Rabbanan required a Kiyum Shtar. The question is, what is the Lover, the Mischayev, what is he saying in Beis Din? If he's saying the whole thing is a forgery, I never borrowed the money, it's a big lie, it's a bluff, then clearly we need Kiyum Shtar. If the Malva can't be Mekayim the Shtar, he's out, as we said, out in the cold. The Shtar is not worth, in America we'd say a dime, in England maybe a penny, I don't know what. And that's it. Geendik demais. But what happens if the lover, instead of saying the whole thing's a bluff, he says, I did borrow the money, but I paid it back. Now, as a general rule, he's not believed to say, I paid it back, because the mal has what? Has a shtar. The question is, but the shtar is not makuyam. So what do we do in this case? Do we upgrade the status of the shtar to a shtar, even though there's no kiyum on the shtar, and therefore the lover is not believed to say parati? Or should we say no? The shtar is not a shtar makuya. The lover could have easily have said mizuyov, it's a forgery, and then he would have blown the whole thing out of the water. That's all. Tell the malva to just pack his bags and go home. He has no claim in court. Instead, the lover was an honest-to-goodness guy, and he said, look, I'm not going to say what I could have said, what any lawyer would have encouraged me to say in Beis Din, I don't know. And I'm not going to claim it's mezuyah if I'm going to admit that the shtar is valid, but I'm going to tell you I paid it back. So what do we do in that case? Well, it's sort of like a migu against the shtar, if you follow me. We should believe him because he could have said mezuyah. But on the other hand, he's testifying against the shtar. And a person is not believed to say parati against the shtar. Mm-hmm. On the third hand, the shtar is not makuya. So what do we do in this case? So this is called mode b'shtar sheksofa. If the lova admits that the shtar was written, and it's not a forgery, one mandiora says, ein tzarech l'kaimo, and the other mandiora says, tzarech l'kaimo. Let's go through the two shittas. The mandiora says, ein tzarech l'kaimo, he's saying, look, why do you need kiyum on the shtar? The mischayev, the lover, who stands to lose the shtar, admits that the shtar is a valid shtar. What could be better than that? You know, what you're standing on your head to find two aiden to validate the signature. Who needs to validate the signature? The lover himself admits, for God's sakes, that the shtar is valid. That's called modem shtar sheksovo ein tzarech l'kaimo. And since it's ein tzarech l'kaimo, that elevates the shtar into the level of a shtar kosher, and against the shtar kosher, the law was not believed, even with all the migus in the world, to say parat. The other man, the Omer says, vodim shtashik savo tzarech lekayim. Why? Because the love could have easily said mizuyah. So right now the shtar is in balance. We don't know whether it's valid or not. If that be the case, let's accept the migu of the lova, that he could have said mizuyuf, and let's trust him against the shtar sheina mekuyam to say parat. That's the machlokus between Rabbi Meir and the Chacham. Hmm. The Edim are talking about a shtar that doesn't have kiyum on it, but yet the lova, by his own admission, validates the shtar. If you hold mode of a shtar shek sova, ain't tzarech l'kaimo, meaning his, the lowest hodah, substitutes for the kiyum, then what we have in front of us is a shtar mekuyo. If the Edom now come and say ksav yadenu hu, but it's kemen sheyigin shuvin echozer umagin against the shtar mekuyo, as we saw in the Sefer of Mishnah. If on the other hand I hold mode of a shtar shek sova, tzarech l'kaimo, despite the hodah's love, the shtar still has the status of a shtar she'eino mekuyom, then we can introduce the Edom into the picture with a pesha asur, a pesha hiter, and we should believe. Ela says the Gemara, Taima de Rabbi Meir ki de Rav Huna Omer Rav. Ti Omer Rav Huna Omer Rav, mo de vishtar shek sovo, ain't zarech lekaimo. Once the lova says parati instead of saying mizuyah, he has in effect validated the shtar, therefore the shtar now in the hands of the Balva is a valid shtar, it's a shtar mekuyam. The Edom to say ksav yadenu zeh aval and possible shtar not believed against the shtar mekuyam. That's what Rav Meir means when he says that the Edom aren't believed. The Edom aren't believed because the Lov himself is moda on the shtar. The Chachomim, on the other hand, they maintain that modu b'shtar shek sovo tzarech l'kaimo, and since the malva is not able to be mekayim the shtar, the lova is going to be believed to say parati with the migu de mizuyof against the shtar, which is not valid. It's a shtar sheinu mekuyam. If it's a shtar sheinu mekuyam, then the Edom, when they come in and they validate the shtar shuksav yadenu zeh, they have to be believed with the pesha asar hu apeshehitir. And now the Gemara goes on to analyze this machlokes about whether mode of shtar shek sovo tzarech l'kaimo or ain't tzarech l'kaimo. In other words, when the lova says, I borrowed this money, the shtar is true, genuine and valid, but parati, I paid back the shtar. Should we believe the lova or not? What's the status of the shtar? Is the shtar a valid, full-fledged shtar by virtue of the hodah of the lova? That's called ain't tzarech l'kaimo. Or do we say no, even though the love was mode, is tzarech l'kaim? And guf omar avunam arav, mode v'shtashik sovo, ain't tzarech l'kaimo, omalei Rav Nachman, gnuvei lomaloch. We just finished establishing that Rav Meir holds, mode v'shtashik sovo, ain't tzarech l'kaimo. So why do you, Rav Huna, in the name of Rav, have to be machadish as if you discovered something that ain't tzarech l'kaimo? Why don't you just admit the truth? You're not discovering something. You're just paskening like Rabbi Meir. Yisvir aloch ki Rabbi Meir. Emo, you should have said halacha ki Rabbi Meir. And by the way, we derive from this Gemara a methodology that you'll never find an Amora who will say in his own name a certain halacha if that halacha really dates back to a time, unless he doesn't know that. Omalei. And now Rav Huna has Rav Nachman, he has his attention. So he says, Umar, and you Rav Nachman, hechi svirale. You know, you seem to be so surprised that I reflect the halacha that is accepted by Rabbi Meir. What about you? Omalei, Rav Nachman says to Rav Huna, in fact, I hold just the opposite. I hold modu b'shtashik savo tzarech l'kaimo, ki osu l'kama l'dina. When a malva comes in front of me with a shtar in din, you know, in judgment, Amrina Lahu, we tell the malva, Zilu kamayu shtaraihu, go ahead and be makayim your shtar, and then Bechusul Dina, then we'll judge you based on your shtar. But if you can't validate the shtar and authenticate it through kiyum, the shtar is worthless, and the lova will be believed against the malva to say parati. That, Rabosai, is the end of the sugya. The next part of the sugya is a hemshech of the sugya, but it's really a separate sugya. As we close for Meiriv, I just want to tell you that there's a footnote here which is a little bit strange to me. And he says the following, when Rav says Modu Vishtashik Sovo Ein Tzarech L'Kaimo, he says that when the Lova says Parati, he's not believed. Why? Because he's Modu to the Shtar, and the Shtar now is a valid Shtar. It doesn't need Kiyum. Afal Gav De Yesh Lo Migu. Even though the Lova has a very strong Migu, he could have said that the Shtar is a bluff. There's no Kiyum on the Shtar. Instead, he says Mizuya. He says Parati. So he should be believed with a Migu Parati, Migu de Mizuya. And the answer is that despite the greatness of a Migu, Sof Kol Sof Yesh Lamal V'Shtar Mekuyim B'Yodo, Vizui Raya Brura Shalopara. Now, what's going on over here? It's true that when a Lova pays up his Chov, he takes back the Shtar. That's called Shtar Chobiyod, my boy. That's a very strong proof. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the Lova here has a Migu. So how do you balance this? The Migu tips the scale to believe the Lova when he says Parati. The fact that Shtar Chobiyod, my boy, that the Malvis is holding on to the Shtar, tells me not to believe the Lova. How do I juggle this? I don't understand why he assumes that if the Shtar is a Shtar Mekuyam, the principle of Shtar Chobiyodi, my boy, overrides and trumps the principle of Migu. And the answer is because Shtar is Eidus. And nothing can be believed against Eidim. A Migu is not strong enough to topple.
Unless he outright says it's Mizuya.
If he said it's Mizuya, then he's taking it.
Interesting.